I did not write a intro for this one because the last one was long enough and I think intro enough. And one thing I did forget to do in the last one because I didn't write it down in my notes is that I am your host, Kayla, and Amanda is here with me. So if,
surprise.
That's who you've been listening to the last episode. So we left off with Rice, Weiner, and Jordan, who were in the cave when a second lightning strike struck the summit. Esteban was in the like bathroom, quote unquote bathroom area of the summit, and he felt the jolt of the strike, but Weiner was the one who got really absorbed the impact of the strike, and he had an out-of-body experience, and it was like after this he became suicidal. So that's like basically where we left off. So not long after the second strike, Rice seemed to kind of be awoken from his trance, and relatively speaking, he came to quickly. I don't know how quickly you can possibly like, you know, get back into consciousness after being knocked out from a lightning strike, because he was coming back into consciousness and moaning and groaning and talking about like what the heck just happened. Weiner had something to distract himself from his own pain and his own experience, and it shifted his attention away from all of that going on enough to forget about crawling to the edge and throwing himself off a cliff. So Weiner had collapsed on top of Rice's legs. Rice first helped Weiner roll off of his legs, and then Weiner removed his belt so that way he and Rice could work themselves up into a seated position. And they looked over at Brian Jordan, who was one of the twin boys, and they noticed that he was blue. And I wanted to bring that up because you know more about like medical stuff than I do. And my thought process is that, like, once you've died, do you turn blue? Is that a thing?
My understanding is that blue comes from lack of oxygen.
Yes.
Not, like, death.
Okay. 'Cause that's what I was also thinking.
Yeah.
Which would imply that Brian Jordan has survived for a period of time after being struck by lightning. He just wasn't able to, like, I don't know if he was just like paralyzed or mentally incompetent of doing anything. So I just thought that was an interesting,
Is that the guy that was in the cave?
So there were three in the cave. There was, Rice was sitting. I can actually show you a picture, and I'm going to put this picture. It's not an actual picture of them in the cave, but it gives you an idea of how the cave was set up, or like where they kind of were. So inside of the cave, there's like larger boulders that they can use as seats. So Rice was all the way in the back where there's a small opening, which if you go look on social media, I'll post this picture, you can see the small opening in the back. He had collapsed to the right side and his leg was underneath the boulder that's sitting kind of in front of this rock, and I'll show you that. And so then
three of them were in there.
Yes. And so then along the like the I guess it would be like the left side inside of the cave was Weiner and Brian Jordan. Brian was sitting closest to the entrance, and he had a backpack with a metal frame next to him, and he had the jolt of lightning went through his chest.
Right.
And then after the first strike, Weiner left the cave to go check on his friend and then ended up going back into the cave. So he, at that point, went back to check on Rice. And so he was farther into the cave when the second strike occurred. So I believe that they believed Brian Jordan was dead right after the first.
Yeah.
But the fact that he turned blue makes me question. Not that there might have been anything that, like, clearly they couldn't do anything. They were all struggling for their own lives.
Yeah.
But that's it's a sad thing to think about. That.
Yeah, I think he was not getting oxygen. Because, I mean, if you were to just have a heart attack and die, like, you're not going to turn blue.
Right.
Blue is like the oxygenated blood is not being pumped through, is my understanding. And so that's when you are suffocating.
Yeah.
Is when you have that.
Okay.
That change in color.
Okay.
I think I'm right, but someone could fact
check me. If there's, if anybody knows better and knows more than us, just write in. Let us know. We'll correct it.
Yeah. Which is interesting. So he turned blue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he did pass.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So from his location in the cave, Weiner was able to see out of the cave and saw that the rain had pretty much stopped and the sky was starting to clear out. And it was at this time that, even though they were completely unable to move, they just started screaming for help, not even sure that anybody would hear them. So with the sky clearing, though, Mike Hogue, who had stayed dry with the others under their tarp, had decided that he was going to climb to the summit to get a photo of the sunset. And he initially asked the others to come with him, but nobody else got up. So he was like, all right, fine. I'm going to go up there myself. And so he made his way up the cables. And once he reached the top, he saw someone laying on the ground waving at him. And he was like, what the heck is this? What is going on? And this person was Esteban, who had begun to crawl back towards the cave. And he was starting to get some sort of sensation back in his legs. So he was on all fours, but he still couldn't stand up and he couldn't get his legs to move like on their own. And he had like just collapsed when he saw that somebody came up from the cables, and this person was Mike Hogue. So initially, Hogue was really worried because he thought that Esteban might have been high on drugs because he was acting really weird. And like the very brief intrusive thought that he had was that if he went over to them, he was going to get thrown off the cliff, because this was how weird that Esteban was acting. So he still made his way over, and when Esteban told him that they were injured, the two made their way over to the cave to see what was going on there. First, they saw Weiner, who was acting crazy and begging to be moved out of the cave. Rice was right beside him and just seemed completely out of energy. He had slumped over in his seated position. His face was pale and his eyes glazed over once again. Both men's legs were smoking and the cave stunk of burned flesh. Hogue was a trained EMT and immediately knew things were not good. His training kicked in and he started to kind of triage the scene and started with Brian Jordan. He ignored Weiner and Rice, who were both pleading with him and trying to, just begging him to get them out of the cave. And he checked Brian over and could not find a pulse. He then moved to Weiner, then Rice, and then last Esteban. And because he had no avenue, of course, to check Frith, he just kind of took that as a mental note that there had been a fifth man who had fallen off of the face of the cliff.
Wait, how did he know there was a fifth?
They told him.
Oh. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Esteban was recovering pretty quickly at this point for, you know, having been struck by lightning. And he was able to help Hoag push the rock off of Rice's legs and then manually picked up Rice, followed by Weiner, and removed them from the cave. So Esteban at this point is like managing pretty well. The list of worries that Hoag came up with was a long one. Shock, infections, burn, heart attack, spinal cord damage, blood loss, edema, and thus restricted blood flow, brain damage, damage to vital organs, and hypothermia were all at the top of the list.
That's it?
That's it.
I think that's everything.
That's everything that could possibly have. So unbeknownst to anyone on the summit, though, Rick Pedroncelli had just arrived. So he gets there and he sees Hoag tending to two people laying flat on the ground, and there was a third just kind of sitting off to the side, and he also was like, what the heck is going on here? As he approached, Hoag and Esteban saw him and asked for help getting the sleeping bags and mattresses and any extra clothing out of the packs in the cave to help keep Weiner and Rice warm in order to help ward off shock. And at this point, once they got as much warm clothing and sleeping bags and whatnot that they could, Hoag told Pedroncelli to go get Linda. So Linda is also an EMT, and she has a little bit more field experience. We're going to talk about why, but that's why he specifically was like, hey, we need her up here. So she was actually already on her way up, and she had no idea how this trip was going to alter her life. So she went to college where she specialized in sports medicine and physical therapy, and she also received education on whitewater rescues. She and Mike Hoag, they're both trained as emergency medical technicians, but Linda's trainer had been diligent about wilderness training too, so she had knowledge specific to this situation. Linda was on her way up, and about halfway there, she saw Pedroncelli show up to the top of the cables, and he was like frantically waving her to hurry up. And as she got closer, she could hear him yelling, hurry up, lightning killed two guys, three others are hurt. So once she got up there, she took over because, like I said, she had more experience with this particular situation. And because they were in an outdoor setting with very limited supplies, she had to improve from the very start. Improvise. She had to improvise. Okay.
I wasn't going to say anything.
I do that sometimes. I'll like, every now and then, like, I'll say something really, like, really off the wall, and I won't catch it, and like nobody else like tells me about it, and I'll be like listening to it, and I'm like, crap, now I gotta cut that whole sentence out or leave it in for comical effect. But
I
like,
literally saw the word improve in my head, and I was like, oh, she meant improvise. She must have typed it wrong.
Well, that was actually a handwritten note, so my handwriting's not that great. So shortly after this, two more hikers arrived who were also EMTs. Their names were or are Renee Miller and Brutus. Oh. That's the name he gave was Brutus.
Brutus. Okay.
So the four EMTs got to work assessing and treating as best they could. They found bullet-sized holes in both Rice and Weiner's ankles and feet. They both had large lesions on their back. Both of them had feeling in their legs, which was good, but Linda was concerned because she could see their legs were beginning to swell, and this could cut off blood circulation, which would then cause muscle and tissue to die, and then those toxins could be cycled through the rest of their body, and it's a recipe for disaster on top of the disaster they're already dealing with. So while it wasn't quite dark enough yet, Pedroncelli grabbed a flashlight, took a seat near the ledge, which dropped over Yosemite Valley, and started signaling SOS, which, if anyone does not know, and I really think that this is just something that should be common knowledge, we should teach this to all of our children, SOS is Morse code for an emergency, and in this case, they used it in a visual way of communicating. It can also be a, like, you can use it as beeps to be a hear, like a way to hear communication when you cannot see another person, or like knocking on a wall somewhere. But the, in this case, because they're using a flashlight, I'm going to use that as the example. SOS would be three short bursts of the light, three long bursts, and then three short bursts again. So three short, three long, three short. And this was happening at about 7:50 p.m. So it wasn't dark enough for anyone in the valley to see this flashlight yet. But Hoag was running back and forth from the cables, looking for anyone who might be coming up, so that way he could turn them around to get help. And it was about this same time that Brian Cage and his group arrived to the base of the cables. They saw Hoag, and he yelled down to them to go get help. People were injured, and they couldn't quite hear him. So they were like, okay, what is he saying? And they all made their way up to the summit. And as soon as they got there, Linda was like, oh, good, more people, I need you, and put them to work. So she designated people to focus on a specific person, because if there's any changes or any declines, you're more likely to notice that change or that decline if you're sticking with the same person. One of the things that she really needed extra bodies for was to hold Rice's head still, and also hold his right leg in a traction position, because he had been complaining about this leg hurting more than anything else. And when he was laying flat, she noticed that his foot was angled in a really odd position, and she was really worried that it was broken. So at this point, with more people showing up and helping Linda, Hoag decided that he needed to run for help. So Hoag and Linda's brother, Dan, are both endurance runners.
Oh, so perfect.
Perfect. So as he is coming down the trail, he sees Pippi, Bruce Jordan, and Buckner and Elner were all coming down the same trail, working their way up towards the summit. And they, of course, are completely unaware of what happened. And as they're working their way up the stairs to Subdome, Mike is running down the stairs, and he mentions to them that hikers had been struck by lightning on the summit. And Elner immediately is like, nope, I'm out, goodbye. And he turned around and started hiking back the opposite direction. So
to get help, or
because he was over the trip, he wasn't expect. I think if I remember correctly, Elner was like the least fit person, and he wasn't expecting to have to hike 9.5 miles to get to the location. And then he wasn't expecting to have to climb up a 400-foot sheer wall, essentially, to get to the top. And I think he was already like having, his legs were cramping and he was not having a good time. So he like heard that lightning has struck the summit, and he was like, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm done.
That's enough for me.
So Buckner, Pippi, and Bruce Jordan made their way up the cables. And as they were doing so, Pedron Selly started to come down, and he gave them more details, stating that two had died and one of them was just a kid. So Buckner and Pippi were basically the two adults with Bruce Jordan, who's the twin of Brian, who died. So Pippi immediately was like, it's a different kid. It's not someone that we know. Like, there must have been more people at the summit than we realized. Like, it is not Brian. And Buckner was like hyper aware of Bruce, who was standing next to him at this point, and just was like, I feel like the way that he described it was like, he was just like basically like feeling the emotions that came off of Bruce as that information sunk in, that a kid had been struck by lightning and died. So they, when they get to the summit, Rice, of course, who has no filter, starts yelling to them that Frith and Brian were dead, and Buckner also at this point was like, I'm done, I'm out, and he turned around and went back down the cables. So Pippi starts sobbing because of the news, because Pippi had a relationship with the twin boys, and Bruce just basically stood there in stunned silence and had like almost no reaction. So at the same time, Hoag had arrived back at his group's original camp, and he and Dan decided that they were going to run for help. And their intended target was a ranger station that was just under 5 miles away, which, and I don't know the terrain in Yosemite, but if I were to estimate a runner, I mean, I don't need to estimate, because this was occurring at like 8:30-ish p.m. that they started running, and they make it there within an hour. So they were moving at a good, pretty good pace.
Is it actually 5 miles, or
it was like four and like just over 3/4 mile to get to the ranger station.
Okay.
At 8:45 p.m., Linda had enough of Pippi crying, who, like, he basically was just, like, sobbing and sobbing and sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And she grabbed him by the shoulders and shook him until he, like, brought his attention to her. And she was like, you need to pay attention to Bruce. You brought him here. His brother is dead. You need to keep him safe. You need to keep him away from the ledge. You need to keep him away from the emergency area. You keep him away from that cave. You get him in the center. You keep him there. And you be the mentally stable adult that he needs right now.
So they made it to the... They went up to the top?
Yes.
Did they know that Brian was dead before they...
They were like halfway up the cables when they were told that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like maybe that's not the place for them to be, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I would... Yikes. But I think at that point there was also the concern that he might... Bruce might just like... decide that he wants to be with his brother, and the rock is so sheer going down that if they tried to descend, he might have just been like, peace, and let himself go.
Yeah.
Which, they had already had enough happen. They didn't need to add another person to it. So, okay, Paul Kobenschlag and Zip Cotter, they were both with Brian Cage's group. They also knew SOS. So when Pedro and Sally left the area, they took over signaling. And so kind of a quick, funny-ish story here. Kobenschlag was taking a quick nap while he was sitting near the ledge, because like they'd been up there for a while now. And he was just like relaxing, and he was like in that space between like being fully conscious and fully asleep, and he felt something touch his hand. And in response to this, he tossed his arm out to the side and flung his hand, and he realized like mid-fling that this tiny furry little creature that he had just flung off the side of Half Dome was likely a chipmunk.
Oh!
So...
No!
So, like, I read that and I'm like, okay, see, this is the support for why you shouldn't feed the squirrels and the chipmunks at the summits of things, because then they won't go looking in people's hands.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, so the lesson is don't feed the animals, and also don't fling the animals, because...
chipmunks, like, uh-oh.
He was like, oh, I just did that. So as the evening went on, Linda started feeling confident that Rice's leg was not broken, but the two men's muscles were cramping and swelling significantly. And on top of this, they found that neither was able to pee to relieve themselves. So they also had nerve damage going on.
No.
So around 9 p.m., It was finally dark enough to see the light from the SOS signal, and Pippi noticed that Kobenschlag and Cotter were actually signaling OSO, which does not signal anything.
Oh my gosh.
So he goes over, he corrects them, and it took minutes before a light on the valley floor flashed back an SOK signal, which means that somebody understands you're in trouble, you need help, and they're going to help you.
Okay, but also, if someone's flashing OSO, it would peak like, all right, maybe they've got it backwards, and like, because otherwise, why would they be?
Yeah, why would it continue?
They've clearly got the letters mixed up, and it's supposed to be SOS.
If you know SOK, you should recognize
like
they're backwards, they're reversed,
yeah,
and maybe the things are so traumatic that they don't actually realize that they're backwards.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean,
okay.
So luckily, things were starting to move at this point. So Jim Riley, who was a supervising ranger, asked John Dill, who was a member of the park's search and rescue, to figure out what was going on. He drove out to Mirror Lake so that way he could see the summit of Half Dome, and then used a bullhorn hooked up to an amplifier and started shouting questions to the summit, which began at 9:25 p.m. Dill would yell the questions to Kobenschlag and Cotter. Cotter would run to Linda for answers, and Kobenschlag would then signal yes with one blink of his flashlight or no with two blinks. And the following questions are pulled directly from the book because there's really no way to summarize the line of questions and not only the gravity of what the answers held, but also the just thoroughness of the question and answers. And like, I was just impressed because like in a world of technology where you can just get on your phone and be like, what's going on? They had to ask questions when there was no clear line of communication. It was yes, no's, and you just had to keep going until you had the information that you have. So
they probably had to be really like sophisticated in that we need to get the most information as quickly as possible with a yes or no answer.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know if time's of the essence, then maybe they didn't have a lot of time to put thought into that. But
I mean,
it's definitely part of it. Like, okay, what do I ask first? What's the most important to get a yes or no response?
Yes.
And then like, then what's the next most important to get the most amount of information?
Right. Yeah. You know? So Dill shouts or asks, is this emergency for real? Because of course there's people who play pranks all the time, and you never want to spend the time and the resources to find out that it was a prank the whole time. So they answer yes. Is anyone dead? Yes. How many? Two blinks. Is anyone injured? Yes. How many? Three blinks. Are the injuries a result of a fall? No. Is anyone bleeding? No. Are there broken bones? No. If you don't receive help, will someone die? And that's where I'm like, oh, they're being thorough about this because no one's fallen, no one's bleeding, there's no broken bones. What the heck else could be going on? Like, what's the emergency essentially at that point?
Yeah.
So with this question, everyone zeroed in on Linda when Dill shouted up his last question. Linda later says, quote, until I had to respond to this question, I hadn't needed to think about it this way. When I shouted yes, it was as if we all accepted that yes, this could happen. Moments passed without questions from Riley, and then, if we can't get to you tonight, will someone die? With all eyes on Linda, she hollered more resolutely this time, yes. There was an extended pause below, and then Riley shouted up that he would get back to them. And for the first time that night, Linda felt like the nightmare was about to end and that paramedics and park rangers were going to show up soon. Little did they know
Yeah.
that they their search and rescue was actually shorthanded in the park on this particular night because a party of four, two women and two girls, had gotten lost in the park. Two of them needed medication, and because they didn't plan to be in the park after, like, past supper time, they didn't bring their medication with them. So there's already a search and rescue party handling that particular thing. And once Dill reported the information to Riley, Riley sent out three park search and rescue paramedics. But if you'll remember from the last episode, we talked about how the majority of this park is, they don't allow for motored vehicles or ATVs or like anything to like quickly allow you to get back and forth. So these three men set out on horseback, and by this time it was so dark out that the men could not see where they were going. Horses are extremely sensitive to light. Very, very sensitive. So if you're in the dark and you have a flashlight out, the horse is going to have trouble seeing. So at this point, they were like, well, we just got to trust that the horse is going to stay on the trail. And that might sound like an absolutely terrifying thing, but I can pretty much promise you that most well-trained horses in this situation, like, these are not just a horse that you pull out of the barn. They're not one of my horses that you pull out of the barn. They're specifically trained for the backcountry experience, and they're going to stay on the trail. The horse knows where it's going and how to, you know, if a cougar was to show up or anything like that. I feel like that's like the thing that plays over in my mind is like, what if a cougar shows up and tries to jump on the horse? Like, they're going to know where to go. They're going to be able to see, and they're going to be able to, as long as you stay on the back of the horse, they're going to take you where you need to go to be safe. But you just got to trust an animal, which is also very hard.
Presumably they've been on these trails before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Most, I think, from my understanding, most horses that are within national parks are like, it's almost like a police dog. Like they work in the field. They've been trained in the field. They know what they're doing, and they're not really like released into the field until they're confident that right. They know.
And I'm sure part of the training is exposing them to the stimuli within Yellowstone, which is going to be different than another environment.
Yes.
So the sounds and the smells are going to be different. So you want to acclimate them to this specific situation, environment,
yep,
that they're going to be working in.
And yes,
you need them like focused and
yes,
not taken off guard.
Yes.
And spooked.
Yeah. And you know, the personality and yeah. I'm not going to go down the wormhole of horses and whatnot. So,
how long has it been since lightning struck to
at this help point
on the way?
At this point, it's been about 3 hours.
Okay.
Or maybe it might be closer to four by okay. this point. So at the same time that the conversation is happening between Dill and the people on the summit, Hoag and Dan arrived at the ranger station in Little Yosemite Valley and reported the same information to rangers Scott Jackson and Colin Campbell. And it didn't take long before these four were on the trail heading back for the summit. As the night wore on, Linda was getting more and more frustrated with being thrust into this position of being the lead medical personnel and having the life of two men in her hands and in her decision-making capacity, both of whom she didn't really No, and quite frankly, what she knew of them, she thought poorly of. And if you'll remember back to when they were kind of all in the falls and kind of like gathered in this like one specific area, Rice and Weiner and a couple others had gone skinny dipping. And Linda was one of the people who was like, wow, these guys are behaving really inappropriately. There's children around here. Like, I don't want anything to do with them. Get me out of here. So she already had this sense about them. Hoag thought that they were on drugs when he first showed up onto the summit. So like, there's a clear line of thought of how they portrayed these individuals already, and now they're having to save their lives, which, I mean, destiny does funny things too. Yeah. In addition to her growing frustrations, Weiner and Rice's legs were both losing circulation, so she and Renee Miller were constantly rubbing and massaging their legs, and they were able to, while they were doing this, to try to get the fluid that was collecting in their muscles to kind of redistribute a little bit. And in addition to this, Weiner was starting to lose his grip on hope, and Rice was becoming extremely angry. So you've got someone who's mad and letting everybody know about it. And then the other guy who's like, I'm it. This is it. I'm done. I'm dying. This is the way I go. And
mad about what? What's he, do we know what he was expressing?
So basically Linda wasn't letting him move because she was worried about, I believe there was a neck injury that she was concerned about and his leg that she was concerned about. And so she was like, you got to stay in this position and we'll move you when it's safe, but it's not safe. So throughout all of this, Esteban was the only one who was kind of able to bring either of them back down and to reality. And even though his injuries were significantly less, and there's debate on whether he could have gotten down the cables and essentially hiked out or if he truly needed to wait for a helicopter. But he decided to sit and he would talk with them and just be there with them and, you know, hear them through their complaints and try to keep them as like mentally stable as possible. And he felt like he kind of needed to take on this role because when the second lightning strike occurred, he basically abandoned them and took off and was like, save yourself. And he had a little bit of like that survivor's mm-hmm. guilt going.
Yep.
So by 10:20 p.m., there were still no rangers, no paramedics or other hikers that had arrived, nor had anyone shouted up to them through a bullhorn again. And the group at the summit began to accept that they were going to be here potentially all night. Everyone with bags began to pull out their spare clothing, sleeping bags, mattresses, and tents to try to provide some sort of shelter from the cold. Jokes were being told to help lighten the heaviness that descended upon them. And then after about 20 minutes, Rice suddenly, again, acting perfectly in character, screamed out that he was going to vomit. Everyone scrambled and Linda, White, and Cage quickly turned him on his side. And once he was there, he chuckled and said, I just wanted to make sure y'all know what you are doing.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
So.
All right. Well, I mean, he did get struck by lightning, so there's yeah, that.
There's that.
Give him a little bit of grace.
From what I read of the book of like the after effects, like this event changed him for the better, it sounds like. I don't think he quite lost his like personality about it, but it seems like he mellowed after the recovery process. But we're not there yet.
Yeah.
So he plays really cruel jokes on the people who are taking care of him.
Wow.
And so while this might have been really annoying in the moment, it seemed to help break some of the tension that they were all feeling. And Rice, while he was still agitated and in a great amount of pain, was having moments where his silly personality was breaking through, which was a positive sign. Linda was fearing the worst and wouldn't let either Weiner or Rice fall asleep, and she insisted that the teams keep them both awake. She was constantly checking for a pulse in both legs, making sure that neither was showing obvious signs of shock, treating what she could when she could, because after all, she was on the summit providing medical care with no equipment. And as the minutes continued to creep on, Linda knew that if she started to let her stress show, that everyone else would notice and follow her downturn in emotions. She had already concluded that Rice would likely live through the night, but Weiner was in real distress and he believed that he was going to die. He was rolling in and out of consciousness, and when he was awake, he spent more and more of that time sobbing in his extreme pain, and it seemed like he was caving in on himself and was listening to those around him less and less. Finally, at about midnight, roughly 6 hours after being struck by lightning, Campbell and Jackson arrived on scene, much to Linda's relief. However, they noticed how well she was caring for the men and determined that she was fine on her own and started taking action to set up a landing pad for a potential helicopter rescue.
Okay.
So an hour earlier, Riley, the supervising ranger, was extremely concerned with the cloud cover making a helicopter rescue impossible. But when the skies started to clear at 11, he decided to make a call for a rescue, even though he didn't actually know, one, what the situation was, or if the cloud cover was going to come back and they would have to call off the flight. So he decided to contact Memorial Hospital for a med flight, which was located about 100 miles west of where they currently were.
Oh.
Helicopter rescues are particularly challenging in Yosemite because there isn't a good source of natural light, and at night, all they have to go on is moonlight, which is pretty much just enough to get by. The lights that are attached to helicopters don't light up the area very well, like cars, for example. Cars are also moving much slower than helicopters are, so you have more time to react if you see, you know, something in the road, or you come across a house, or, you know, those types of a thing. But because they're in the air, there's nothing for that light to illuminate. So you don't know, like, the light's serving no purpose at that point. So another problem is that, unlike with cars, well, I kind of already summed that up, but being unable to see or get a visual, pilots can become disoriented and not recognize. Okay, so I'm going to back up, actually. So the light from the moon is going to light up barely all of your surroundings. If you turn lights on the helicopter, you then lose sight of what that moon is lighting up. What that moon is lighting up is also how pilots get their bearings for, like, which way is up, which way is down, like where they're at. And if they don't have that, it's really easy for helicopters to turn and potentially go completely upside down. Oh. And you don't actually know what's happening until you're in that position. So the other issue with that is that if you end up in an uncontrolled descent, because you didn't know where your bearings were and you didn't know where everything was, those are very hard to recover from. And so because of this, I'm not going to say that helicopters don't use lights, because clearly at times they do, but there's many circumstances where adding lights to the helicopter makes it more dangerous than just using what natural light is there is.
Are they also dependent on their devices?
I think now technology is better with with what there is.
What is it, altimeter or something?
I think at this point in time, the devices were basically how they kept balance. And flying a helicopter is not like driving a car. Flying a car is not like driving a car. It's not. You got to have someone really confident to be able to go into, like, specifically this area and be able to manage it. And we're going to talk about that why in a second. So based on the report that they were given, on the moonlight in Yosemite, pilot Al Major found that he had until 1:42 a.m. because at that time the moon would set beyond the ridges in Yosemite, making a helicopter rescue a non-viable option. And at 11:23, They took off for their 37-minute flight to Yosemite, meaning that once he arrived, he would have 1 hour and 42 minutes to complete the rescue. With the size of the helicopter, he was only able to pick up one injured party at a time and fly them down to Crane Flats, which was where they decided to create a landing pad because it was a larger area than what Yosemite Valley had to offer. Crane Flats is a campground that is located about 30 minutes driving time northwest of the valley. It was here that Major would fly the victims to be picked up by an ambulance and then taken to a hospital. On board the helicopter was also EMT Bill Bryant and flight nurse Maggie Newman. Bryant was very experienced and very crafty, and if he thought things would be done in a better or a different way than what protocol dictated, he didn't have a problem following his gut to do things, and often he was right. He was also one of the EMTs who taught Linda the very skills that she was using at the summit.
Oh, nice.
So by the time Campbell and Jackson arrived at the summit, they already knew a helicopter was coming, or that a helicopter at least was called. And so they were like, all right, we need to create a place for this helicopter to land. And they basically swept the area as clear as they could of debris. And then themselves, along with six others, grabbed flashlights to make a circle to light up the landing zone. Watching the sky, those on the summit finally saw a single bright dot that grew larger and larger. At about 12:45 a.m., the helicopter arrived at the summit and set down so gently, no one knew it landed until Major cut the engine. Very quickly, they determined that all that could be done medically at the summit was already being done, and with a very close eye on the clouds, knowing they couldn't fly if they covered the moon again, they asked who needed to go first. Without hesitation, Linda said Weiner. Loading him onto the helicopter, Major started his flight down. First they went up, and then they entered into a black hole. No light shone off of anything that would allow those inside the helicopter to see where they were, where the trees were, where the sides of the mountains or ridges were, and yet Major felt at home and in control, flying blind.
Wow. I just got nervous as you described it.
Yeah. There were a couple of people who, a couple of like the rangers that ended up in the helicopter to assist with getting people down. And in the book, they make comments about how terrifying it was to, like, you can see where you're at and what you're doing. And then they cut the lights and it was like,
oh, that would be so scary.
You know nothing. And you just, it's again, one of those things where you have to trust who's in control. And it's I think it's very hard for humans to give up control.
Can you imagine flying in a helicopter in pitch black?
No.
In mountains?
I
would be terrified.
My goal is to never end up in a helicopter.
Honestly, I don't ever want to do helicopters either.
Yeah.
That's a different story.
So down in the valley, park rangers had their vehicles parked with lights turned on, all doing some sort of job. Some were lighting up the landing pad, others were parked beneath power lines, and others were there just to create a point of reference for Major to fly to. Later, he described the scene as lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, I bet.
So
nice.
At 1:07 a.m., he landed, and Weiner was taken straight to an ambulance. And Major did not stick around. He went up again and landed for the second time on the summit at 1:15 a.m. This time he left the engine running and Rice was already on a stretcher. Taking off again, he landed to drop off Rice at 1:25 a.m. And at 1:30 a.m., Major landed the helicopter for the last time on the summit to pick up Esteban. As he lifted from the summit, the moon slipped behind the ridge and Major successfully removed all three men who had been injured by the lightning from the summit.
Nick of time, man.
Yeah. Later, Rice and Weiner would be transported to the University of California's Davis Medical Center, as they had the area's largest trauma center. The following morning, the bodies of Frith and Brian Jordan would be recovered. Both Rice and Weiner had severely damaged kidneys because of the toxins released from their muscles and filtered through their blood. Because they both had compartment syndrome, which is a severe swelling in the legs that blocks blood flow and limits the ability for the brain to send signals to the legs, that very first morning, like, they got to the hospital in, like, the very, very early hours, and they were pretty much taken straight into surgery. So they both had surgery to relieve the pressure built up in their legs by having the lining of the muscles cut to allow the muscles to essentially overflow. And this negates the permanent damage that would be done otherwise that would likely lead to one or more leg being lost.
I'm going to YouTube that, I think, later. I'm very curious what that looks like.
So, the first time that I heard about compartment syndrome, have you heard of the TV show called Bones?
Yeah.
Okay. I was obsessed with it. I'm still obsessed with it. Love that show so much. And it's one of those shows where I will not watch the last season because I know it's the last season and I'm not emotionally capable of handling that.
Have you ever seen the last season?
I have not. Nope.
Okay.
I know at some point I'm going to need to watch it. And it's probably going to be like one of those things where like I accidentally just start watching it and I'm going to be like, oh, cool. I haven't seen this one. And I'm not going to recognize.
And then, like, you're going to see the last episode and then go for like wait for the next one and then be devastated it's over.
So if you see me in the gym just bawling my eyes out, just know. So there was an episode where they talked about compartment syndrome, and I remember all of it, but I'm not going to describe it to you guys because you guys can go watch it yourselves.
Yeah.
But they talked about like compartment syndrome and like what they needed to do, and the one lady like essentially needed to do surgery on this guy without any anesthesia or without anything to help. And I remember like watching the scene and I was like, why? Like, what is this? So I Googled it and I'm scarred. I'm not a medical person.
It's that gnarly.
Like it's pretty gross.
Yeah,
like,
I'm going to have to see this.
In severe cases, it's like, you would probably be like, wow, that's really interesting. But like,
I mean, I obviously have a lot of questions because like you can cut the lining to release it, but like, what do you, how long are you waiting? Do you leave it open? And then like, what is that process like?
Yeah. So they actually, I don't remember how long it said that they basically had their muscles exposed. Oof. For, but it was a good amount of time. They also would then have their feet held in contraptions to keep their ankles flexed. So that way their Achilles tendons wouldn't shorten due to the inactivity that they were experiencing at this time. And that therefore wouldn't cause any gait issues later down the road. Rice's legs were in the worst shape, and the entire time, or the entire calf had been torn in half on his right leg, and the wound was 2 to 3 inches deep.
Oh my, from the
lightning.
Oh my God.
And because of this, doctors were unsure if he would ever walk again. And during the time that he was in the hospital, this is a very interesting thing. During the time that he was in the hospital, Linda would come to visit him more than once. So she was pretty much the only visitor who had been there that he didn't act out towards. So he kind of pushed away Esteban and he pushed away some of the other people who were there. But then whenever Linda showed up, he was just grateful and appreciated because she saved his life.
Yeah.
And I think rightfully so. She did a lot of work to save their lives. And despite Linda originally not liking Rice at all, they became friends. Rice really couldn't put into words how much he appreciated her efforts on the summit. But when Rice was released 3 months later, so he was in the hospital for 3 months.
Yeah.
Linda was there to watch him walk out on his own.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So Weiner, at his worst, was in kidney failure, gained 40 pounds of retained fluid overnight, and was
overnight?
Overnight.
Holy cow. Yeah. That's got to be super painful.
So bad.
40 pounds?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
a lot.
That's a lot. That's a frightening amount.
That's a lot, a lot.
So he was told, like Rice, that he may never walk again. And his body just was not handling things well. And he ended up having pneumonia in addition to several other infections and also began to have heart problems. As soon as it was safe to do so, he was transferred to Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston so that way he could be closer to his family. And they pretty much, once he got there, they bathed him in silver nitrate, so much so that his nails turned black. But after 6 weeks in the hospital, in comparison to Rice's 3 months, Weiner had recovered enough to be released.
Okay.
For a year following the release, Weiner had to attend physical therapy appointments, wore pressure bandages for a year and a half, and absolutely suffered from PTSD. Simple things like driving and connecting with friends suddenly felt impossible, and it took him a decade to recognize when happiness had finally returned to his life. Oof. So he really, really went through it. To help cope, he started volunteering his time at a local animal hospital and then continued doing this for several years until in May of 2000, after returning to school, he received his veterinary degree.
Aww.
He currently has his own veterinary practice, has 8 dogs, several cats, 3 horses, several foster dogs, and a granddaughter and twin grandsons.
Aww.
So he found, I think, purpose with animals.
Yeah.
Which is...
I mean, there's nothing an animal can't fix.
Oh, for sure.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also nothing an animal can't break, in my opinion. So, so despite only a few park personnel being named, there was a larger effort being done than what I can describe in this episode alone. Of all of those involved, 59 in total, between the lightning strikes and the women who were lost, everyone received the Exemplary Act Award, which is an outstanding performance award given by the National Park Service.
Aw, so that's nice.
That's
wow.
The Cliff Notes version of Shattered Air. Jeez. By Bob Magic.
That's wild. All I could think about when you were talking about them being helicoptered out, so... They're all three of them are removed by 2 a.m., but everyone left, I assume, is camping on the summit until there's morning light.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much are they thinking about another storm rolling in? And, like, what do you do?
No one's sleeping. I can guarantee you no one's sleeping on that. Like, you might be there, but you're not sleeping, and you're waiting for that thunder, and you're...
Yeah. I mean, you just hustle off.
Yeah.
I don't know the logistics and how realistic that is, but I would be very, very on edge being up top.
Yes.
After all of that for, you know, a few hours in the dark.
Can you imagine also thinking about that while caring for people?
Well, yeah.
And being like, okay, what's the game plan for if this happens again? What do we do? Because... No one wants
to stay up there.
You don't want to be there, but you also cannot get them down. Like,
yeah, so then you just leave them until the storm passes?
What do you,
Dude, yeah, that's, I mean, thankfully they didn't have to deal with that, but that would be something in the forefront of my mind.
Oh, for sure. It's lightning. I am going to knock on wood so hard. But I have not been affected by lightning. The closest I've come, we had a metal pot on my back porch last summer that got struck by lightning.
What?
That's closest I've ever come to having lightning affect me personally.
Yeah.
So the lid is all like janky now. It's got like a real sharp in
no
at
way.
The edge. I'll have to show you sometime when you come over again.
How did you guys hear it? Were you home?
It was in the middle of the night. It banged so loud. It woke us up. Dogs were barking, of course, because what the heck is going on? And I was like, you know, my mom's got like a lot of kind of like loose decorations around the house. There's ladders, there's pallets, there's stuff. And I, like, we were like, okay, one of the pallets must have fallen or like pulled away from the house and then landed real hard against it. Could not figure it out. And then a couple of days later, my mom went to go get the pot in because, and I can't remember exactly what she was using it for, but it's the largest pot that we have. It's like a real big, like stew.
Yeah.
You put like, you can probably fit a turkey in this thing. So she goes to get it in and she was like, oh my God. She's like, what happened to this? Why is this bent? Like, this is the weirdest thing. And then we remembered a couple nights prior,
what
was this thing that occurred? And we were like, it has to match up. There's no other way. Like, I'll have to show you. There's no explanation for how this thing got warped the way that it did.
Yeah.
Other than lightning must have struck it.
Do you still use it?
Not for cooking.
What do you use it for?
My mom's really weird about certain things, but when she's planting her plants, she'll take the soil from the bag, put it in the pot, and then carry the pot through the house to the backyard.
Okay.
And dig the soil out of it from there. So it hasn't been used for cooking in a long time.
Okay.
But she'll do things like that. Or like if she's transferring plants, she'll use it to carry plants from one area to another. And I'm like, Mom, you know that a pot is heavier than a bag.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, but it's just convenient. It works. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to be That's weird funny. Like that too someday. So
I'm going to have my own quirks. That's fine.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a wild story. Yeah. Pretty terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, when Sam and I went to Zion a couple years ago now, we went during like their quote-unquote rainy season. And there were a couple of times where we, like, Angel's Landing is high elevation in the park. And we did a couple other places too. And I was like, hey, if we happen to see a storm brewing on the horizon, we're not sticking around.
Yeah.
We're not doing it. Like, I'm not chancing it at all. We had several days in the park. Like, I was like, we can come back to do this if we need to. Like, we're not doing it. And Sam's very much like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
It's up to you. But, I am notoriously playing it safe most of the time.
Yeah. So when did this happen? What year?
1985 or 87.
Okay. When did the book come out? When was that written?
2005.
Okay. Do we know anything about, like, did anyone talk to Bruce Jordan?
So his family sued the park for, basically saying that they were negligent and didn't have the proper signage to prevent something like this from happening. But based on other cases that involved very similar circumstances, they didn't hold up in their claim. So they ended up dropping the charges. And basically after that, they like were not able to be contacted. So I tried to look up, I tried to look up information about Linda. I tried to look up information about Tom. I just happened to be able to find Weiner because I knew that he had gone to Boston. And so I was like, all right, he probably then also was like receiving support from his parents. So he was probably stayed close to them. So he probably went to college near them. And I found when he graduated college. And so then I was able to Google his like specific degree with his name and found his biography for a prior vet clinic. And then I found like his current vet clinic from there. So it was like a whole line.
You really Sherlock Holmes that.
I was trying.
Nice. Yeah, I'd be curious to know if Bruce had any inclination beforehand that something had happened.
Yeah.
I mean, my mom's a twin. She kind of talks about
I'm a twin. I don't know that you knew that.
What?
My twin died very shortly before we were born.
Oh, wait, I might have known that.
So I have a twin, and I have this weird thing where like I'll be like randomly drawn to people and I can't explain why. Like I might not even like them that much, but I'm like, I just want to be near them. And then I find out that they're a twin and I'm like, that makes sense. Like that, like
interesting
that I almost feel like, you know, you have like a connection and an energy when you're in the womb with someone and that connection never goes away. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what makes sense in my mind is that because I no longer have that connection outside of the womb, it's easier for me to recognize it in others.
Yeah.
And it's not because like I'm like sitting there looking for that connection because I have what I need. But like I said, I'm just like randomly drawn to these people. And I'm like, this does not make any sense. I don't understand why. And then I learned they're a twin. And I'm like, that's it. Oh, that's so it.
Interesting. Yeah, my mom talks about like the connection with her sister. She doesn't know any different because she's always been a twin, but she does describe it as a very unique, seemingly unique experience and feeling.
It's so, unlike anything else, I'm sure.
Yeah, so I'd be interested to know. I mean, we probably won't ever know, but if he reacted the way he did because there was a sense of something before he knew.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, who knows, but that's tragic.
All right. Well, we're getting towards the end of what my computer I have. Oop. It goes 1 hour and 15 minutes and we're at 1:10, which is actually perfect because I got to get home to put little man to bed. So Amanda, thank you for doing this one with me. Yeah. Also,
thanks for having me again.
I'm sure there will be more. You seem to be the person when I'm like, I have a two-parter that really digs deep on something. I'm like, Amanda,
sign me up.
So
I love it.
All right. Thank you for listening and thank you for being here and thanks for the wine.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and to share a story of your own, send us a campfire confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.